Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest today is Luke from Continuum Drag, and we are going to be talking about Larry Niven's Ringworld, which won the 1971 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So Luke, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan. I really enjoy this podcast, so it's really fun to be on it.
Awesome. Yeah, I've been looking forward to talking to you. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Continuum Drag?
Sure. It's kind of like the very dumb version of your podcast, where instead of reading award-winning science fiction novels, we watch very little seen science fiction television, which sometimes means it's also very bad.
Right.
But I think in theory, they're a similar concept of exploring science fiction sort of from the past, except, you know, you've picked quality and we've gone a very different direction.
Yeah. I mean, it's a mixed bag, right? Because it's not like television somehow is less worthy of discussion than books. But you've kind of, I guess there's sort of a Sturgeon's Law thing that comes into effect with almost anything, right? Where the cream rises to the top. I think Sturgeon's Law is 90% of everything is crap. But, you know, you can, in the course of doing what you're doing, you can also find some kind of hidden gems and go, well, why did that get canceled? You know, that was actually pretty good.
It's true. Occasionally we will come across something that surprises us and is much better than we think. Having watched so much of it, it's funny to recognize so many tropes now. Like I just see them so frequently that even in Ringworld, I was like, oh, there's a classic trope that I've seen a million times now.
Yeah. How did you come up with the idea to do this?
My co-host and I, Jordan, we had been sort of just chatting about contemporary science fiction shows and like what was on right now. And we started talking about how neither of us had ever watched Babylon 5. And we're like, hey, that's an interesting thing that we never watched. What is, you know, maybe not for everyone, but I think for science fiction TV, it has a bit of a cornerstone.
Yeah.
And we realized it's so long. There's so many seasons of it. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. We just sort of started spitballing from there and kind of came up with this idea where we would dig into science fiction TV we hadn't seen. And as it's turned out, there's so much of it. We thought we were pretty well acquainted with science fiction television, much less acquainted than we realized.
Right. I like the fact that, though, you have a built-in kind of ripcord system where if it's really, really bad, then you get to pull the plug before too long.
Yes, we have a escape pod on the show where if it sort of like is a bad show that it's hard to watch, we can kind of get out. It originated when we started watching Tech War, and a couple episodes in, we realized it's like, this is going to be a tough show to watch. Although we ended up watching far more of it than we ever expected. But it is kind of like, you're right, a fail safe to get us out. Sometimes I feel we leave a little too soon from things, but you know, it's all a matter of taste.
Yeah. Well, it can be kind of soul-crushing, too, to have to keep plowing through something you're not enjoying.
Well, I think that's the idea, is how do we keep this fun and light and not something we hate doing every week?
Yeah. I enjoyed when you guys were talking about the Planet of the Apes television series, because I remember watching that as a kid.
Oh, that one was such a surprise. It was so much better than I ever would have expected.
Yeah. Well, definitely if you ever get to doing some stuff from the 80s like Auto Man or Manimal, keep me in mind.
Great. Auto Man and Manimal. Let me guarantee you those are on the list.
Okay. Excellent. Yes. Those are shows that, you know, as a kid, you don't have much discernment and I have no idea how those would hold up. I just remember enjoying them when I was a kid.
It is funny seeing how things change over time.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, let's move from talking about your podcast to a little bit about yourself. You know, what's your history as a science fiction fan?
Sure. Sounds good. I was trying to think about this because I know you ask everyone when they come on. And I was, I'm trying to remember when science fiction came into my life. I feel like it probably started when I was like 12 or 13 because like Star Trek The Next Generation was on syndication and like I got home from school and it was on and that was something I just started watching. It really feels like that was my sort of first encounter with it.
Okay.
And then science fiction literature I was just like, where did I get the first books that direction from? And I think like when I was a kid, I watched Jurassic Park and obviously loved that. So I started reading Michael Crichton novels, which are pretty loose science fiction, some of them.
Yeah.
But I had a cousin who I think lent me Ender's Game. And I'm guessing that would probably be the first like true science fiction book I read.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, I think they were the ones who kind of recommended stuff to me after that. The two cousins who seemed to, I don't know where, how they got into it so heavily, but they seemed to have a pretty good knowledge base of it.
Nice. Yeah, that's actually similar to me because I think when, I mean, I read lots of Star Trek novels and that kind of stuff, but when I actually started getting into reading more, you know, the canon of science fiction, Ender's Game was one of the first ones that somebody lent me.
It's a good one, I think, when you're, you know, a teen or a preteen, because it's got a lot for you to connect with.
Yeah. And I didn't get it until I was, you know, 32 or 33 years old. So
speaking of Star Trek novels, my co-host Jordan got me one for my birthday. So I'm midway through a like 2018 written Star Trek The Next Generation novel. Not as bad as you would expect.
Oh, really? Okay. See, I was wondering about that because I read them in the, you know, the 80s and into the 90s. I read a couple dozen of the Next Generation books and some of the Deep Space Nine and a few of the classic kind of TOS ones. But
you must have read M'Zada.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep. That was one of the giant novels that came out, right? One of the hardcovers. So, cool. All right. Well, why don't we talk about Ringworld? Why this book? Why did you choose this one?
I chose this one because I've read it before. I've read a bunch of Larry Niven's short fiction too. Mm. I don't know. I think I picked up a short story collection when I was at a used bookstore at some point. And he kind of has, I don't know, I'm not for sure if this term is correct, but he kind of, I feel like he leans into hard science fiction a bit. He's very much interested in kind of like the science that makes these things go. Though, as I was researching the book, I think I've read that a lot of his hard science is called into question in general. Mm-hmm. But it was just one of these guys who I think were the first kind of people I read who did a little bit of this hard science fiction.
Yeah, it's interesting because this book actually, in places, does read like hard science fiction, like something like Rendezvous with Rama. But it also has teleportation and faster-than-light travel, or at least, you know, relativistic travel.
Right.
And some kind of miraculous stuff in it. So I'm not sure it really fits into hard science fiction, but it does read like it in places.
Yeah, and it's funny, rereading this and thinking about it for the podcast, I was like, it really isn't quite hard science fiction. It has elements of it, but even like the little bits feel like classic science fiction, because all aliens are very like one's a cat race, one's like, they kind of have that classic science fiction, almost Star Wars-y kind of feel.
Yeah. So this one is a first time read for me, thank you very much. This has actually put me over the hump to where I'm now exactly halfway through the total list.
Wow.
So I've read 36 and there's 72, including the Retro Hugos. Actually, you know what? It just occurred to me I didn't add the Retro Hugo winner from this year. Dang it. I have to go back and recrunch my numbers. but on the existing list, at least looks like I'm halfway.
Well, congratulations. Cool. That's a real accomplishment.
Yeah. And it's three times my original number. So.
Three times your original number. Man, oh man. Wait till you're finished. It's gonna feel like it's such an accomplishment.
I know, and then I'm going to have to find another list.
I mean.
I have to start going through the nebulas and the locuses and the John W. Campbell.
Lists everywhere for you.
There are, yeah. So in terms of overall thoughts on this one, I did really enjoy this one. I read a big chunk of it in one night when I was up with nausea, which is not a great...
That's, you know, perfect time to enjoy a book.
Yeah, just like, am I going to puke at some point? I think I am. So I'm just gonna sit here in the bathroom with a book and see what happens. And nothing happened other than I read, you know, 80 pages of Ringworld that I really enjoyed.
That's good. So, I mean, I feel like it's a pretty easy read, so it's not a bad time to be reading it.
Yeah. So before we go any further, can you give kind of a brief elevator pitch, you know, small synopsis of the book without too many spoilers?
Sure, I'll try to give us the log line for it. It's about a character named Louis Wu, who on his 200th birthday is approached by a member of an alien species called the Pearson's Puppeteers, who is thought to have left the galaxy. They haven't been seen in, I guess, centuries. And he's offered a job to explore an unknown, I guess, object out in space with a crew of aliens and humans, and in return he'll get a great prize that will help humanity in the future. I think that about sums it up, ish.
Yeah, I think that does. And it keeps all the mystery there.
Yeah, I didn't reveal anything. I didn't even mention the ring world, which is in the title.
Right. That is the unknown object, in case anybody's wondering. And I mean,
that's not really a spoiler, I guess.
Yeah. So I want to talk about kind of in terms of recommending this novel, you know, what is it similar to in tone or style, you know, that you might be able to recommend it to somebody on that basis?
Well, I was rereading it for the podcast. I was trying to think, how would I recommend it? What would I compare it to? And I actually feel like it is a more sci-fi focused Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm. Like the characters are fun and weird and never at odds exactly, but there's a lot of like internal bickering. But I constantly think of the character, what's his name, Speaker to Animals, feels so much like one of the characters from that movie who's like very flat in tone, but it all comes off as either sarcastic or like. So I'm not sure. I felt like it has that fun adventure quality that Guardians of the Galaxy has, but is far less comic booky, far more science fiction driven.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good analogy. I hadn't thought of this one. Like I mentioned, it does remind me a little bit of Rendezvous with Rama in that you're inside a structure and exploring it. And for some of it, that's not necessarily a positive thing for me because Rama, I'm not a huge fan of it. Just because it was kind of, and then they went to this place and they looked at this thing and here's the thing they found. And then they moved on to another one with a bunch of description. Ringworld doesn't fall into as much of that because it is kind of character driven.
Yeah, it has a little bit, I think, but yeah, I think a little more character stuff.
Yeah. And the characters are interesting enough and different enough that it keeps it entertaining. And you mentioned the Pearson's Puppeteer. And one thing that I really love in science fiction is when an alien is very alien, right? And the puppeteers are absolutely very alien.
100%.
Right? Yeah, because I mean, they've got the three legs, right? So kind of tripod stance almost. And then they're
two heads.
Yeah, two heads on big long stalks that have one eye each and lips that are used like, you know, prehensile fingers.
Yeah, it is such a crazy, every time I try to envision it, I just think of my own hand and I just hold like two fingers up and put the other three down. I'm like, I guess that's what it is.
Yeah.
But it is really kind of a fantastic creation. I mean, the Kazin, Speaker to Animals, is, you know, basically a giant cat, which is pretty, pretty basic as far as an alien life form goes. But his imagination for the Pearson's Puppeteer, which also great name for an alien race.
Yes.
I love these elements of it.
Yeah, and Nessus, the puppeteer, right, is not quite the typical puppeteer either.
Yeah.
They say he's crazy.
He is crazy. His breakdown of how these races work is kind of fun. All of his ideas are fun. Like, they're a race of cowards.
Right.
So no one's seen them because they would never risk seeing someone else. And everything is like, they, you know, basically live in a padded room, so they're safe. So for Nessus to go out into this world and find Louis Wu in order to like go off on adventure, he, by the very nature of his species, is insane.
Well, yeah, and I love the fact that at various points in the book, he just curls up in a ball and goes catatonic. Yeah,
that's his survival mechanism. I think at some point they ask, like there's a quote in the book somewhere where they're asking him about like, why is he the insane one? And he's just like, because the majority is sane. So as long as the majority says this is true, anyone who says the opposite is an insane person.
Yeah. So let's run down the character, actually, because we have Louis Wu, like you said. We have Nessus, the Pearson's Puppeteer. We have Speaker to Animals, which I think is just one of the best names in science fiction. Who's the Kazin, right? He's the big cat guy. And then we have Teela, which reminds me of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, because I think there was a character named Teela.
That's
there.
Very funny. That's right. Teela, she another human, but this one only 20 years old as opposed to Lewis's 200.
Right. And I don't want to go too much into her because of there's a certain reason that she's in the crew that I want to save for spoilers.
Absolutely.
I will say that, you know, this is 1970 science fiction, and as such, the roles of the women.
Yeah.
In the adventure are not what we would call ideal or woke.
I mean, I guess we could maybe save that for the spoiler space, but yeah, you want the lowlights of this book are its female characters. And almost to the point when I was thinking about it, I'm like, such lowlights that they could almost spoil the book potentially.
Yeah, and I'm sure there would be some people who'd be reading it and like that would be something they couldn't get past. And I couldn't criticize
100%.
I'd be like, no, yeah. on the other hand, when you're reading something that's of its time, it just kind of, it goes with the territory, right?
Yeah, it is that balance. I mean, maybe we'll save it for spoilers, because I would like to talk about some of these elements, because I think you're right, some of it is of its time. I think some of it just speaks to maybe some bad writing.
Yeah, well, before we get to spoilers, I mean, anything else you want to talk about in non-spoilers? I always wonder, you know, what is how something goes on a reread versus a first time read.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to say before we get into to the spoiler section, since some people I'm sure will turn it off before they get there. The book is quite fun, and I know I just was getting on its case for some of these characters, but overall, I think it is a good, enjoyable time. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. The characters are, for the most part, fun. The situations they get into are quite a lot of fun. All the backstory and universe building. Like, it seems like his whole idea when he comes into this is like, how can I make this as fun and weird as possible? And
right.
Every kind of reveal of like a piece of backstory or how this race functions or what happened in the Mankazin Wars, like, they all feel like just like, here's a fun idea. Like, let me explain this fun idea to you for like 3 pages and we'll move on. And the chapters fly by. They're all real short and they move, and it's such a quick, fun read.
Yeah. I was actually listening to a podcast with my previous guests on it from Sci-Fi Sidebar, and they were talking about this, and they had a lot of negative things to say, but they, you know, they came around to saying, look, this book is a ton of fun. It's really good. It has some things in it that are problematic.
This feels like Larry Niven and his whole known universe, which this is a piece of, like, his, you know, all his books, not all of them, but a big majority of them, like, take place in a single unified sort of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like you could make something out of it, fix kind of these problems of their time with some of the characters, and have something incredibly fun and exciting. And I read a quote from Larry somewhere that said, Larry, like, I know him, I use his first name. Right. He sort of said, this is a place that, like, he'd welcome anyone to play in. Like, he created the known use, but he feels no real ownership over it. He's kind of just like, yeah, I think anyone who wanted to come in and have a good time in this universe would be more than welcome to. And I think he's co-written a lot of books, so I feel like he has a good sensibility that not all of it's right or perfect, but that other people could come in and have a great time in it. And it's a nice idea for someone who's like, come on in, make a TV show, make a movie, write a book about it. Like, there's lots of fun to be had for everyone.
Yeah, definitely. And all right, so there was one other thing I wanted to talk about, and I forgot what it is, and so I'm hoping it'll come back to us in spoiler talk, but I think it's time to just go ahead and move into spoilers so that all subjects are on the table.
Let's get into it.
So anything you want to talk about, just kind of freeform discussion, we don't have to walk through the plot, but any point that you want to talk about, let's do it.
I want to get through some of the lowlights of these two female characters they have so I can focus on some of the stuff I really enjoy, but...
Good idea.
I just feel like it's tough to talk about this book without kind of looking at the huge blind spot he brings to these two characters in the book who really are the low points. So with Teela, he has a really cool core concept because over the course of the book, you find out Teela is the result of a experiment that the Pearson puppeteers have been running on humanity for centuries, presumably. And that is that they've been breeding humanity for luck.
Right.
They want to make a lucky human being, which is such a fun idea.
Yeah, like a psi power of luck, right? Not just randomness.
Not randomness, but essentially whatever... And it's kind of nice because they never fully commit to exactly how it works.
Right.
And it's kind of
You can't. Therein lies madness, right?
Yeah, there's not fate necessarily. It's just the idea that for Teela Brown, she's like this woman who was born after... generations and generations of people have been sort of won a birth lottery. So on Earth, you can have X number of children or you can earn a child this way. But there's also a lottery where if you win, you can have an extra kid or you can have your first kid.
Mm-hmm.
And her, I think they say like 5 generations of her family are all birth winners. So she's just like this random circumstance where through just statistical anomalies, she's on the bell curve where all these people happen to get together. They all happen to be born because of the birth lottery, and she's the end result. Mm-hmm. And now anything she does is working out in her favor through no real effort of her own. Just the stars are always aligned to fall in Teela's favor.
And as a result of that, she's never really suffered anything, right?
Yeah.
Never had any real negative circumstances in her life.
It's sort of the idea is, she's nothing truly terrible has ever happened to her. Some sort of bad things, but for the most part, nothing truly awful. Unfortunately, like, because they present her as sort of 20 years old, so she's presented as quite a naive ingenue, and the result, and because this luck thing is supposed to make her even more sheltered, and like, they toy with the idea she's maybe not even really human because she hasn't experienced some of these things.
Yeah.
But a lot of it kind of felt like, because Louis Wu, the person we sort of see her through, is 200 years old and quite experienced, and they're like lovers in it, which has this real weird, like, I'm just like, it's this real weird thing where it's like, yes, he's 200 years old, but of course he has a 20-year-old lover. Like, there's a lot of these weird elements that are a little icky when you think about them.
Yeah. Well, especially when it gets down to the, you know, why did she end up with him, right? And it ended up being essentially an outworking of the luck, because that's, she needed, that needed to happen in order for her to get where she needed to go, which was, which ended up being with another man.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, and he'll
on the ring world. And like, she needed to become the property of this,
yeah, like
this guy on the ring world.
Yeah. He's some sort of like, you know, person from a society who thinks there's ownership over sexes and they have to sell her to him at some point. I mean, all of that is obviously what it is. Mm-hmm. I just felt like there was a way to write her as less of a, she's just kind of always whiny or naive or something. Just because she is lucky and because she lacks some world experience, it just felt like someone writing, it's like, the generations younger than me, they're all such snowflakes. Right. I don't think definitely. He quite meant it that way, but just as a result of her being the only character of that generation, being the only female character for a while, and it, like, all these things add up to just kind of make her the flattest character in the book with the least kind of self-insight or change. Her arc is the toughest of all the characters.
Yes. And yet, you know, she is what drives the plot forward, right? Because without her, they don't accidentally crash land on the ring world.
Very important. Her being there results in a lot of the things that happen to them. And I don't know, it's a bit of a, like you said, because of its time, I think some poor choices on the writer in this particular case, just they could have fleshed her out a little more. They could have given her a little more personality, but he kind of kept her flat because I think that's what he thought that character should be. But it ends up just being a weak part of the book. And I think I've read some criticism even when it came out that Tila was kind of just like always pointed to as just like, this character is just not working. And then, of course, much later in the book, Tila disappears for a little while because she gets lost from the group, all part of her luck, which is needed for her to finally find the man of her dreams on this ring world. Mm-hmm. And they replace her with another female character who is one of the ring world people who hasn't gone like barbaric, who's from an older time. And when we get to meet her, we get to learn that the only other female character is a prostitute from their ships that fly around the universe.
Though she does have one of the great names in science fiction, right?
If you can pronounce this, I will give you a standing ovation.
Haurillo Prillilar. That's how the audiobook said it.
So. Yeah, I would refer to her as Prill as what they shortened it to.
Yeah. No, I did with this book, I did what I've done on some previous ones where I would read up to a section and then listen to the audiobook up to that section as well, just to kind of help it go in.
Very smart. I listened to the audiobook as well, which was not badly done actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's fine. But she also is a pretty flat character who also is there to hook up with Louis Wu.
Because with magical sexy times.
Like, there's this running thread where Louis Wu cannot go literally 10 minutes with a sexual partner.
Yeah, he is very oversexed.
There's a way that could work in this thing. It just because the only characters the only female characters he meets are primarily there to, I mean, both characters, both Prill and Tila at some point say, well, how can you go on a long space mission without someone to have sex with? I need to come with you. Very much a sign of its times. Anyway, maybe we'll move on from this, but I just really felt like I'm just like, why are they, like, especially revisiting, I'm just like, oh man, these two characters, there's, if you walk away from this book because of these two characters, I don't blame you. It is certainly a real mark against the book.
It is. Yeah. Well, so I wanted to talk about Teela and her luck, right? Because first of all, I just don't buy it, right? I don't buy sort of metaphysical luck. I understand randomness, right? But randomness cuts both ways. And so I do think it's interesting that the characters in the book also question it, where Nessus, who has chosen her for this mission, you know, she's the only one that he could contact. And so is that an outworking of her luck, or is that bad luck that she got sent on this mission where they're, you know, they might die on the Ringworld?
Yeah. I love that they never really commit to the luck for sure being a thing. It definitely seems to be playing a part. And anytime in the book where they're trying to extrapolate why the luck did something to get Teela to where she's going, it's them building a narrative that certainly sounds like it could be true, but it also, like, it also could have just been happenstance, or like, how do you know that's what had to happen? It's an interesting idea where there seems to be some statistical odds at play that are forcing Teela, like at some point she's going to crash into a giant tornado. And as the oxygen gets sucked out of her, she loses consciousness and smashes her head on the control board of her flying motorcycle. And it just happens to shoot her out of the right angle to get her out of there. Hence showing her luck saved her life. But then at other times, it's like she needed to be picked for this mission so that she could get to the ring world, so she could meet maybe her true love, because that was the only way she could safely learn how to be human. And also the ring world maybe will protect her from the end of the galaxy. Like, this is all the characters formulating maybe what her luck did to get her here. I don't know. I felt like he balanced pretty well. Like, it's not necessarily like some true force, but like something that the characters around her read into.
Yeah. So kind of catapulting off of the ring world will protect her from the disaster coming, looming in the galaxy, right? Where there's this cloud of stellar particles that are headed towards Earth.
What do they call it? It was the, I wrote it down here. There's like the core explosion.
Core explosion, yeah. That's headed for known space in 20,000 years. And I love the fact that, I think there's a analogy in here, because the puppeteers have been like, 20,000 years? Okay, we're out.
Yeah, they left centuries ago.
Yeah, and where Louis kind of says, well, realistically, even knowing this 20,000 years, we're going to wait 19,090 years and then go, oh yeah, we should probably go. And I thought, that is accurate. That is scarily accurate for the way humans deal with existential threats.
Yeah, yeah. We wait for the climate apocalypse, and 2 minutes before midnight, we're like, oh, I better fix this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, I like the idea that the Ringworld material somehow doesn't emit neutrinos, which is amazing as somebody who's into particle physics.
Yeah, what is it? It rejects like 95% of neutrinos, but lets the other like 3 or 4, like there, it doesn't reject them all. Like, it's such a weird material that they're like, it must be on purpose, but why?
Yeah, but the idea that the core explosion won't affect the ring world.
It's the one place in the known universe that will reflect the core explosion.
Right. And so it's a good place for Teela to be to survive it without having to leave.
Yeah.
Right. And the other thing about the ring world, and we haven't talked about it much specifically, is the scale of it, right? Where it's like the diameter of it is the diameter of like the Earth's orbit around the sun. And then it's also, what, 1 million miles wide?
Yeah. They kind of keep trying to describe it. And it's like it has the surface area of hundreds, thousands, millions of planets. Yeah. It basically, the idea of the ring world is there was a society. I think they keep calling them the engineers or the Ringworld engineers, who they couldn't, for whatever reason, the society never discovered how to do faster than life travel. It just, their technology refused. At some point, Pril, the engineer species, is just like, all our math says that's impossible. And they're like, well, I don't tell you, your math's wrong. But in order to survive, they kept getting bigger and bigger society, taking over more worlds. And eventually, out of desperation, they realized the only way to like get enough space for all the people they were creating was to essentially take all of the planets in their like basically solar system and several others nearby, reform them into a huge ring that circles the sun. And now they've got this planet, this sort of structure. I learned this term. It's a big dumb object, a BDO.
Right.
That basically circles the sun, and they should have enough room to grow theoretically for many, many, many years, because how can you fill up millions of planets? And this huge ring, and they've kind of got walls along the side that keep the oxygen in because it kind of orbits this planet. And then they've got they've built day night cycles by around the sun. They've built the shadow squares. They're essentially just squares with breaks in them that circle the sun, so that on the planet, this big rolling night basically rolls in over top of where you are in the ring world and then passes over as that orbit's passed. Does that make sense? I don't know. It's a crazy book.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where you get into some of the more kind of hard science fiction elements of this, where like, how would this work? How would you have seasons on the ring world? How do you have day and night? And I thought it was really cool, actually.
Yeah, well, and they talk about that too, because what we come to learn when they arrive on the ring world and they crash land there and get stranded is that the puppeteers were worried this was like some really advanced race they should be afraid of. But what they find is like, long ago, the Ringworld people kind of crashed into barbarism. And what they're seeing on this is sort of the remnants of that world. The people who live there don't remember their technological high point. The Ringworld's breaking down. Like, you see the structure, the substructure the Ringworld's made out of across it, because there's been holes punched by little asteroids. This is the big tornado we see, or the big hurricane. Mm-hmm. So it's basically disrupted their ecosystem. And like, basically the Ringworld's on its way out. I mean, it's going to take thousands and thousands and millennia to be destroyed, but this society has collapsed, and it's just in the long, long downward spiral.
Right. Well, so that was one of the other high points for me, was just the notion of how would this civilization collapse, and how could it possibly rise again? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Nessus says it's not like they have ores that they can mine. And so to go from the level of technology that they are back to barbarism, there's no way back from that. Because if you can't smelt metals and that kind of stuff, then you can't get back to a technological age. You know, there's no fossil fuels. And so you can't go from burning trees to nuclear fuel, right?
It's a very fun idea. Like, that's it. They used all the natural resources to build a basically fake planet. So there's nothing to mine. There's nothing to rebuild. I mean, it's, you know, it's an interesting thought. Like, you know, even our cell phones are made out of a like weird minerals on Earth that there's a limited amount of. And if we were to use all those up, collapse back to medieval times, like there's no way to get back. Like, you can't get more of that stuff on your planet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I kind of agree that it does sound like it would be very difficult for them to resurrect that society. On the other hand, things don't always progress linearly, because I remember I was reading a book that was about, it was about the history of science, and there was at some point kind of prediction that we were going to run out of metals like copper.
Right.
And so third world or underdeveloped countries would never get telephones. And what ended up happening was a lot of those countries went straight from no copper wired telephone to cell phones. Because of that technology, they didn't have to take the interim step.
Yeah, they could skip that. They could skip the step.
Yeah.
And I think there's a whole bunch of books in the Ringworld series. I'm sure we'll see a Ringworld resurrection along the way. But
I know. Have you read any of the other books?
I have not, actually. I was, in the course of doing this, I was kind of looking over just how many books are in the known universe, like sequence or series. And it's, Ringworld has its own series, and there's a bunch around there. But I've never gone any further down the way, so I don't really know how it goes.
Okay.
And I'll be honest, actually, I actually think the Ringworld itself is one of the things I find the least interesting about the book. It's very cool, but because it's set back so far technologically, it is a little more of a, it is a little more medieval, and it's not what I love about my science fiction.
Sure.
I found the other societies to be more interesting. So I think maybe that's why I've never pursued the Ringworld series itself.
You know what? I just remembered the thing I was going to talk about, non-spoiler. Woohoo!
Oh, go for it.
The thing I wanted to talk about here is something that I don't enjoy in fantasy books is world building. And in science fiction books, it can kind of be the same, where it can be a slog to put together a universe and tell me all about it. And one of the highlights here is I feel like Niven does a really great job of just, you know, giving little seeds of things and introducing characters like Speaker to Animals and Nessus.
Absolutely.
And telling us a bit about known space without telling us everything. But like, it builds out a very vivid world without burning up a bunch of pages on it. And so I really like that.
He puts a bunch of species together and allows their natural problems or affinities to come out through conversation. This is something actually I'd like to go back to and talk about, because the Ringworld Society is viewed by the puppeteers as a huge potential threat, because they could build this structure that no one in the known universe knows how to build, a huge ringworld. Hence why they send this whole mission off. But what I think Niven does really interestingly is that, so the puppeteers are afraid of a society that could be potentially like catastrophic, could be so powerful they'd be unstoppable.
Yes.
So if you bump back to the puppeteers, what we learned about them is when they left the universe, they are able to put all of their planets into kind of a orbital structure where they're flying all of their planets with their people on it out of the known universe to get away from the core explosion. And when Speaker to Animals, the Kazin, sees this, they're a warlike race, classic trope. They're
Klingons.
A Klingon. And they would kill anyone they came across. When they finally go to the puppeteer ring world for a quick stopover, he looks around and he's just like, they're so powerful. These cowards could wipe us all off the map just by thinking about it. Like, we are nothing compared to them. He's really good at establishing civilizations who are technologically superior, not just minorly, but like astronomically. They're unstoppable by comparison. So it's like a little Russian nesting doll. We've got the humans who are, okay, they've got some power, and the Kazin who are on par with the humans, though they would wipe out the humans if they could. And then you open the nesting doll and you've got the puppeteers who we come to learn are so powerful. They're running breeding experiments on humans. They're running breeding experiments on Kazin without their knowledge. And they're like, they're basically gods to us. And then we pull out from that, and the Ringworld engineers are gods to the puppeteers. And even as they're talking about it, at some point, Louis brings it up to Speaker to Animals. He's just like, listen, if you steal this faster than light ship, you could definitely wipe us all out, because this is kind of a fear that the Kazin will steal it and take it back to his people and they'll become warlike again. He's like, eventually, you're going to bump into a civilization that's better than the engineers, and they're going to crush you like an ant. Like, the idea that it's just, like, out there in space, like, there's always a better species waiting to crush you.
Yeah, well, and the idea that you'll end up with this expansionist policy, right, where you string out so far that you're too spread out, right? Like if you ever played a game of Risk where somebody has just decided, I'm going to burn out everything on one turn and I'm going to conquer as many things as I can. And then they end up with one army on every country that they have, and somebody comes in and just takes them down in one turn.
Well, that's the Kazin race. They're just, all they want is expansion.
Yes. Well, and that's what I love about Speaker to Animals too, right? Is that he's very self-aware of what his race will do, of what his people will do. And says, well, I can't tell anybody about this. If I tell them about this technology, if I tell them, you know, about the things that I've learned here, we're going to end up trying to conquer everybody. And we can't do that.
Well, that's the Kazin race we learn over the course of this book is really interesting. Like, we find out one of the first species Earth met was the Kazin. They immediately went to war, and like, Earth was barely staying on top. Like, humanity was barely staying ahead of these wars, thanks to just like their propulsion system could be used as a weapon. So they managed to stop the first Kazin war. And
the Kazin were pretty bad at tactics.
Pretty bad at tactics. But ultimately, it looked like they would lose, except a group called the Outsiders, a race showed up and sold them faster than light travel, basically.
Right.
And that turned the stem of the wars. And the Kazin kept losing and losing and losing these wars until finally the Kazin kind of had to learn diplomacy.
Right.
In order to survive, because they, like, what did they say? Like, like two-thirds of their population kept getting wiped out every war. They just, like, throw everything they have at until they're almost extinct.
Right. Well, it was their way of controlling their population, too.
That's true. And then over the course of the book, we come to learn that the Outsiders only showed up at the human colony We Made It because the puppeteers sent a starseed lure, which attracted the Outsiders, who sold them the technology, which allowed them to win. And what we come to learn is that all those wars, this outsider race who showed up, this was all the puppeteers who found the Kazin earlier than that, were a little worried about them, but thought maybe they could be a useful species. They're bold, we're cowards, maybe we could use them. Can we breed them to be more docile? So they set up a series of wars that would beat them down to the point where they would become diplomats against their base nature.
Right.
It's such a long con the puppeteers have been playing.
Yes. Yeah. And it's horrifying in a lot of ways, right? They're
absolutely
taking away the free will of the people that they're messing with. But on the other hand, you can look at it and you'd be like, well, that was probably a good thing overall.
I think the puppeteers kind of see themselves, you know, obviously it's all very self-interest driven, but they're like, oh, you know, we helped you. Like, you guys would be extinct right now.
Say thank you.
We would have just wiped you off the planet, like off the universe. You would be gone. And like, that's a big part of the book too, is as these secrets come out, there's fights with the puppeteer, like the Kazin loses, like, you know, he's so offended. Tila becomes offended by the fact she was bred for luck. It's very funny because they're traveling the ring world as like a group of four, and midway mm-hmm. through the book, Nessus is just removed from the party for about a third of the book.
Yes. Well, I love too the character bit there where you're thinking, okay, well, he's a couple days ahead of them or something. And then Louis realizes there's no way that a puppeteer would be the spearhead of an exploration party. He's got to be behind us.
He's circled behind us. He's been following us this whole time.
Yeah. Well, and that whole notion of the leader of the puppeteers is called the hindmost.
The hindmost.
From behind.
Yeah, it's leading from behind. It's very good. I mean, and even when they finally get into some fights with some Ringworld people on the ground, we actually see Nessus get caught in a tough situation. And he seems to turn to run. And from Louis' perspective, he's like, oh, he's going to get killed. Like he's exposing his backside. Mm-hmm. But when he does, his instinct is to kick out with his hind leg and basically kick the heart out of the man right. behind him.
Devastating blow.
A reveal that evolutionarily, it's not cowardism we're seeing. They turn their backs to run because their strongest leg is their hind leg, and it's their best defense. He's very good at seeding these ideas throughout the book. Yeah, there's so much fun stuff. Like we haven't talked about the stepping squares or the transfer booths where you can transport immediately around any planet.
Yeah.
And like humans have some, but the puppeteers are more advanced. And there's just all these like crazy ideas. Like on Earth, society's become homogenized, which is, I think, a classic trope of this kind of era of science fiction.
Yes.
Like there are no races, ever all the cities are the same. But what we see in the culturally is they have the ability to like paint themselves or like change their skin color to be like, when we first meet Tila, she's a starscape, a living starscape with flaming hair. I'm just like, what? Like, I'm just like, what is going on here? And we never spend more than 3 minutes talking about it. And then like, we move on. And I'm just like, there's so much cultural stuff he's developed that I'm like, I would love to know more about that. His 200th birthday, because he's taking booster spice, which allows him to live theoretically forever. I'm just going to run through a bunch of random science, like weird science fiction stuff he has. The Kazin is obviously a huge risk. So how does Nessus keep him at bay? The puppeteer has installed in his head a device called the TASP, which when shot at you causes your brain to release endorphins and like basically giving you the ultimate pleasure.
Yeah. Euphoria.
But it's so powerful that you can basically become immediately addicted and basically become a slave to the person with the TASP. And this is how Nessus is going to control anyone who gets out of line on this mission.
Yeah, it's very different than a torture device.
Yeah, it's just for pleasure. I think at some point someone says, like, leave it to a puppeteer to turn pleasure into a weapon.
Right, yeah. I also, so one of the things that bothers me, particularly in young adult science fiction, or, you know, dystopian science fiction, that kind of stuff, is when there's fake swears. Because it's like the author just wanted to write this very blue, with tons of swearing, but didn't want to actually have parents get upset about him dropping a bunch of F-bombs and that kind of stuff. And so they make up some word that...
Do you not like this word?
Well, no. So my problem with those, when that happens, like what slants from the Reckoners series from Brandon Sanderson or... clunk from the Maze Runner series, right? I'm like, this is not how language works. You don't just come up with new swear words that people know over that short of a period of time, right? Language definitely progresses.
Right.
But in something like this, where it's set in the far future, I have no trouble accepting that tonj is the all-purpose swear word.
It is obviously a bit of an affectation, but I really do like tonj as a swear word.
I do.
I was listening to the Harry Potter episode, and it's the first time I've heard a bleep on your podcast. And I was like, I should record a clean tonj for you, so that should I swear, you can just put tonj over top of
there
it.
We go.
But I love, because he keeps saying tonj. It's like tonj it, tonj this, tonj that.
Tonjing, yeah.
And when they finally reveal what tonj means, I love it so much more. Tonj,
I think I may have missed
is,
that.
It's basically when they're wandering around, every time they say tonj, they're saying, there ain't no justice.
That's right.
Because it's just the first letter of each of those words. And the idea of just like, anytime something goes wrong, being like, ah, there ain't no justice.
Right.
It's such I don't know why, but it really works for me. I love that phrase. And then I love it shortened to tonj. I was really into that in this book.
I never made that connection. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yes. I mean, it was a I remembered it when I reread it. I'm like, that's right. This is one of the things that I thought was so much fun when I first read the book, that I kind of was just like so enamored with just his use, his turn of phrase there. And then it just really speaks to the funness of the whole book. I don't know. For me, this is, it was one of the things that really drew me in.
So we mentioned that the Ringworld civilization had fallen, and there's some kind of theorizing about how that happened. And essentially it's like rats aboard sailing ships, right? That they come into a port and spread plagues. But in this case, I guess the theory is that there's some mold that came on one of the ram ships, and that mold attacked semiconductors or superconductors and that kind of stuff. And so that's why the civilization ended up falling. I kind of look at that and I'm like, were there no simple solar cells or something for power?
It is a good question. And I mean, they kind of don't. I mean, it's funny. He writes it in a way where he can backtrack on it later.
Sure.
Should he need to, because it's all theories by the characters in play.
Yeah.
But he seems to be positing this idea that, yes, that a weird bacteria or something that eats plastic or semiconductors slowly broke down technology. But he really kind of phrases it along the way that it's because the government or the people who ran the Ringworld had become kind of not corrupt, but certainly felt themselves unstoppable. And that kind of opened them up to failures that they refused to see.
Well, and it's very realistic too, right? Where things start to go badly. But if you are in an area and you still have some power, you know, literal power or figurative power, or if you have a power source, you're like, well, we're okay, and we're going to maintain this power as much as possible, and not going to work on the systemic problem that's eventually going to get to us. We're going to hold on to our, you know, clutch our pearls.
We're good.
And yeah, we're good.
Who cares what happens over there? That's their problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the other fun things about this book is that, you know, they're on one of those journeys where they've crashed and they're like, okay, well, we need to get to the rim of the Ringworld in order to find a way to get off of the Ringworld. Because one thing that happened is on their way in, they got hit with a X-ray laser, I think, which just sheared off everything from the ship except for the General Products hull, which is made by the Puppeteers, which I think is just a great name. it's like it sounds like the generic.
Well, that's it. We come to learn the Puppeteers are like just traitors, or they're like this giant corporation that just makes very high quality products.
And so they end up having to. They're like, well, we need to get to the port, wherever the port is, and it would be at the rim, and figure out a way to launch us off the Ringworld. And the velocity of the spin of the Ringworld will push us out to where we can use our star drive, right?
Yeah, get out of here.
And then they don't end up doing that because, of course, it's not going to work because of the way the ports work with this device called the Chiltang Brone that allows essentially for you to phase through the port.
It turns the material that the Ringworld's made out of into semi-permeable, so you can kind of just pop out into space.
You can slip through it, but not the atmosphere won't all completely go out when you do it, although there is some leakage.
But, you know, these are long extinct. Even Prill, who we know has, we find out later, has arrived long after the fall of the Ringworld on one of their, like, supply ships, I guess.
Yeah.
And they talk about how they jury-rigged one to get back onto the Ringworld, and like some guy got stuck in the...
But it failed halfway through.
So it's an interesting idea. Like that's kind of over the first part of the book becomes kind of their motivation. But, you know, they quickly start to learn that the things they need no longer exist.
Yeah.
And it is fun. Like it's a fun adventure in that they don't go very far. Like we're talking about a huge multi like million planet space thing. And the entire journey they have on the Ringworld is from where their ship crashed in the middle of the ring just on a walk toward the wall on one side. Like they barely see any of this Ringworld.
Yeah, I think I saw someplace that there was a calculation that the Ringworld would have more room for, you know, could basically support the entire population of Asimov's Galactic Empire series.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so all the Foundation books, all those planets that everyone could fit there.
I mean,
which is kind of unimaginably large.
He does a pretty good job of like trying to establish the scale in your mind, because the scale is basically unimaginable. It's man, the more I think about this book, the more like kind of crazy the adventures they're having are. Like when they crashed, they ended up cutting a piece of the Shadow Square wire, which falls to Earth with them, or falls to Ringworld with them, which becomes a major plot point later. But it's essentially like a micro filament that'll like slice anything it touches in half.
But it's also super strong.
And will later become the core way they get off the planet.
Right. Thanks to Tila Brown's life.
That's right. And how much did you enjoy the slaver stasis field? Like every time they get into trouble when they're crashing the ship, the book itself just like stops mid-sentence and then picks up again like on the next paragraph. And they're like, stasis field came on. We all froze for 10 minutes and we have no idea what happened.
Right. Yeah, no, I thought that was interesting, where it protects you from any danger, but at the cost of time essentially stopping for you.
Yes, and his effective way of writing it is to literally stop mid-sentence, have like, I think, I can't remember the term he uses, he's just like...
Discontinuity.
He just writes discontinuity on the next line, and then a new paragraph starts.
Yeah.
It's like a missing reel from a film or something.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, I don't even know where to go net from here. Like, there's so much stuff we've barely touched on. Like, it's such a dense book with a lot of big ideas and like weird ideas. And there, basically, every chapter explores a new. Mm-hmm. I feel like almost every chapter explores a new idea from this universe. Yes.
And yet it's not the kind of thing where it's a slog, right? There were some portions of the book where I thought, okay, I guess I know what this book is now. You know, they're going to go here and they're going to explore this thing and they're going to learn this and then they're going to go to the next one. But it's still super readable.
Yeah. I mean, kind of once they crash land on the ring world, the plot kicks in. It's like, they have to get off. So they're like, every chapter kind of gets them a step closer to getting off the planet. And that is maybe the least interesting part. It's like that adventure to get off the planet. But each chapter itself is just like, now, like, we haven't even talked about this, but when they crash land and they're flying on their fly cycles to like get to the ring world rim, the first time they encounter the ring world people, they fly down over a lake and they're kind of fishing in the lake and they look down and they're all freaked out to see the ring world natives. And as they fly away, they're all flying away and they're like, those all look like humans. Right. Why are there humans on the ring world? And you're like, wait, what?
Yes, exactly. And Speaker to Animals confirms it, right? Yeah. He's like, I could smell them. They were men.
And they never get into how that works. There's some indication that maybe Earth is somehow related to the Ringworld. Maybe their exploration ships ended up there and someone got stuck and this is like a place where they just like made raw materials and forgot about. Like, there's all these weird little mysteries that are just galactic in scale that they're never going to be able to get to the bottom of in this book, but they like to tease it throughout the whole book.
Well, yeah, and on that topic, too, all you get is somebody opining about it, right? Where Niven could go back and rewrite it and say, nope, Nessus was wrong with his theory about this, because Nessus kind of spins out a panspermia kind of thing, where maybe the Ringworld engineers actually seeded human life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that the life on the Ringworld is descended from Earth,
right.
It's that Earth life is descended from the Ringworld life. I don't think that works just because of, unless DNA is universal, right? Because you can trace back things in our DNA, you know, that
have
to do with things like producing eggshells, right? You can see the markers in our DNA even though they're inactive, right? And so you can see that there's a clear descent from Earth life,
of course,
simple forms, up into humans. You can't just say, well, we dropped monkeys on there and then they evolved into people. That doesn't work.
I mean, you're right. This is how he smartly gets around that, is he has his characters posit these theories so he can always backtrack on them later. And I don't know if you read this. I guess when the book came out, all these people went through it and were like, the ring world's unstable. Like, it would never hold up. So in future books, he would just use the things they told him, retcon it, because no one quite answered that question the first time. And he was always able to stay ahead of like the engineering nerds or the science nerds. Because it's just characters saying a theory they had, and none of them are like experts in that field. In fact, did you read this when his first publication of the book? Because at the start of the book, he doesn't want his birthday to end, his 200th birthday, so he's always stepping in these transfer booths to jump to where it's not quite midnight yet, somewhere else in the world, so he can stay ahead of basically the time change. And in the first draft of the book, he sent Louis Wu the wrong direction around the Earth.
Oh. So he sent him east instead of west?
Yeah, and he didn't notice. Like, all of his friends made fun of him when the book was published. And in later drafts, in later publications, he retrofitted that to go the right direction.
That's hilarious.
Which I find very funny. Like, he loves science. He's clearly into it. He's clearly into these big ideas. But he's clearly not, like, a guy who, like, worries about them too much. He gets around it by having his characters say things or like have people theorize about them, but he never commits to them himself. Like, he's never like writing it like, this is the hard truth of this world I've built. He's just like, maybe it is, until someone tells me otherwise.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, so like you said, I mean, there's a ton of stuff we could talk about in this book that, you know, we've just brushed on a number of the topics, but, you know, we don't have to keep going forever. But if there's anything else that you want to talk about.
We didn't even talk about the Fist of God.
Right. I mean, that is kind of, that's another outworking of Tila Brown's luck, right? That they end up right there.
Yeah.
And that's where you kind of get your first idea of, wait, this isn't a real mountain. I mean, it looks like a volcano, but it can't be a volcano because there can't be any magma.
I think.
I hadn't ever kind of gone, you know what? I bet that mountain's going to end up being important. And so when it ended up being what it was, I thought, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's it. There's just so much little detail, and we save it for the reader. You guys can get into what the Fist of God Mountain is, but it's mm-hmm. like, it just, he's giving you so much that these little things, like, what's this giant mountain that like is so big it goes past the sky? It's just like, don't worry about it. There's too much other stuff to worry about. And then when the big reveal comes later, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yep. Well, and I like too that the local people who are there see it as a symbol of deity or something, mm-hmm. right? They're calling it the Fist of God, right? That is very realistic, where something like that being there would have significance to anyone who lived there.
Absolutely. An impossibly large mountain.
Mm-hmm. It's Olympus, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I think it's probably about time to wrap it up.
Yeah, we could go forever.
Yeah. Well, any final thoughts on this one?
I think this book is a lot of fun. I don't think if you've ever read Larry Niven before, it'll definitely, I think, excite you about reading some of his other books. Because, I don't know, the short stories I've read of his also have a similar feel. They always have kind of fun core characters built into what is just like one big weird idea. Okay. That is, I don't know, it's the kind of science fiction I really love. And in the way, like, I like Three Body Problem because it's such big ideas and so crazy. Like, that entire trilogy is like bigger ideas and bigger ideas. But their characters can be a little dull or a little less like fleshed out. Mm-hmm. He's a bit better at fleshing out a fun character to put in the mix of these things. Larry is, anyway. Larry. You know, my buddy Larry.
Lair. We call him Lair. Yeah. This was my first experience with Niven, really. I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was a ton of fun. I would be interested to read further in the series if I had more time for reading.
You've got a lot to read.
But it might be one that where I pick up audiobooks and kind of catch up on the series that way, because I've done that with some other things, like the Vorkosigan Saga, which I've read a couple of those for the podcast, and then my library has all the audiobooks, and so I've just been burning through that series.
Yeah, I think his writing is interesting too, because like obviously there's a whole Ringworld series about the Ringworld going forward, but if you don't want that, there's like a Kazin Man War series. You want to read about the Kazin Man War instead? Is that more interesting to you? Like, I feel like this book is a nice Rosetta Stone probably for his work. I mean, I haven't read all of his work, so don't quote me. But like, he teases so many ideas, like the Puppeteers, the Man-Kazin War, what's going on with the Ringworld. And then he has like a bunch of books written in this known universe. And I feel like if there's a thing you think is the most interesting part of this book, you can probably find a book he's written that will satisfy that itch.
Right.
Like, there's a whole thing about the man who went to the core explosion to see what it looks like, and they just talked about him in reference, like the puppeteer sent him there. I think there's a bunch of writing about him somewhere.
Yeah, probably.
It's an interesting series that I don't think, like, I don't ever hear people talking about. It's like, hey, you read Larry Niven's Known Universe?
Right. Yeah.
Maybe, I think Amazon might have the rights, though, so maybe if we just sit around long enough, we can just wait for the show to come out.
Right, yeah. No, this would definitely be an interesting thing to adapt, because you would want to make some changes to the way the female characters are drawn.
Yeah. I think an adaptation of this is primed to go. I think whoever does it right could be sitting on a very nice little franchise for themselves.
Yep, definitely. All right, so before we sign off, how can people find you?
Well, you can find me at my podcast with my co-host Jordan, Continuum Drag. We're at, I think Twitter and Instagram is the easiest place to find us, at Continuum Drag, and that'll loop you back to the podcast itself. I think it might be continuumdrag.podbean.com is the URL, but I don't know. Maybe just Google it. Nice. If you want to hear about old science fiction shows, some good, some bad, and two very dumb people trying to work their way through them.
Well, it is always entertaining, so.
Yeah, hopefully it's entertaining. your words to the listener's ears. I'm on Twitter at A Luke Black. So you can follow my, I don't know what, personal retweets there. I have no idea.
Right.
All right. Well, Seth, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on. I am a big fan of this podcast. I can't wait to listen to more of it. And it just really, truly an honor to be on here with you. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, man. I really appreciate you reaching out to me. And yeah, I love the networking opportunity that this podcast affords me, because like every time I'm either, you know, pulling listeners to my podcast from somebody else's, or driving listeners from mine to somebody else's. And I think it's cool. And I want to thank you right back. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you too.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Luke, and I definitely recommend you check out Continuum Drag, particularly if you're a science fiction fan and you like the idea of checking out some kind of defunct, canceled, you know, short-lived television series. Luke and Jordan do a great job. They have some great guests on to talk about some very interesting properties. I particularly recommend the Planet of the Apes series that they did. So I'll make sure to put all the links to their social and their podcast in the show notes. Make sure to check that out. Of course, as always, you can reach out to me at Hugo's Podcast on Twitter. You can send me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or you can go up to the website and fill out the contact form if you want to get in touch. It's always nice to know people are out there and listening and enjoying the show. Of course, if you are enjoying the show, if you'd like to support the work that I do here on Hugo's There and on Brief and Not So Brief with my son and on Take Me to Your Reader with James and Colin, you can support me on Patreon at patreon.com/hugospodcast. So I think that about does it for this month. I will talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.